As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
Hello and welcome to the TIFO Football Podcast. I am John McKenzie and I'm joined as I always am by my good friend and producer Mike Zimmerman. Mike, how's it going?
It's going well, John. A lot going on. We've got AFCON kicking off, Asian Cup, the NFL playoffs over here are about to start. So just so much going on, so much to be excited about.
And speaking of excitement, we have yet another exciting guest here on the TIFO Football Podcast, because this week I was lucky enough to talk to Alex Stoyle, who is a sports psychologist who works for a company called Optimize Potential. We had a lot to talk about in terms of the more mental aspects of football. And Mike, you've just listened to that conversation. What did you take away from it?
Well, I think the timing of this episode is great because, you know, one of the biggest storylines right now is Jadon Sancho's loan to Dortmund from Manchester United. And we saw that relationship break down between Sancho and Ten Hag over time. Alex talks about what the role of a sports psychologist plays in regards to communication between managers and players, and whether managers even consult sports psychologists in order to nurture their relationship with players.
Yeah, and as we say, it's just such an important aspect of modern football that it's really good that we could have Alex on. And as always, the best thing for us to do is to just switch over to that conversation. So the next voice you will hear is me talking to Alex Stoyle, the sports psychologist. Alex, it's so good to have you on today. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you very much for having me.
I think the best place for us to begin is to give a little bit of context so our listeners know exactly what it is that you do. So tell us a little bit about yourself, what you do, and how you ended up doing it.
So I am a sports psychologist in training. I am currently doing a doctorate at the University of Portsmouth, which is kind of looking at a couple of different topics. And then I also am a practicing sports psychologist working across a number of different sports, both with organizations and kind of individual sort of private clients who come my way.
So when you say that you're a sports psychologist in training, does that mean you start out life as a regular psychologist and then specialize?
So there's different ways to get to where you want to go if you want to be a sports psychologist. So from the kind of starting with undergrad, you can either do a sort of, you do the sports and then you add the psychology, or you kind of do the psychology and add the sport. You either do undergrad in that, then there is a sort of a one-year master's in sports and exercise psychology. And then after that, there's a sort of a training period, which is kind of maybe akin to sort of being sort of junior doctor or a trainee solicitor. So you're kind of on the job, you've got supervision to look over you. I'm doing that through my doctorate, but there's a couple of other options out there, which are the sort of, I guess, perhaps the more mainstream options through a couple of organizations who oversee that process.
So did you do psychology or sports for your undergrad?
So I did psychology, but through a rather circuitous route. So to get to where I am today, I actually spent 10 years working in a completely separate field in a sort of corporate world, having studied history as an undergrad, and then I did psychology to kind of convert into this role.
I wanted to begin with a bit of a weird question. It's a little bit of a highfalutin question, perhaps. But we had a fitness and conditioning expert on the podcast a few weeks ago, and I posed the question, what is physicality? Just a really broad, general question about the topic that we're talking about. And I thought we could do the same with you and ask the question, what is psychology? So again, it's quite a difficult question to answer, perhaps, but I think it's going to be fundamental to everything that we're going to talk about today. So I thought it was really nice to just set the bedrock of the conversation by talking about what is psychology. So how would you answer that question?
So I love a highfalutin question, so no need to apologize. Right. There I think most kind of definitions kind of come out somewhere around sort of like a study of the mind and behavior, and I think those two different points are quite important, because it's not just quote-unquote just the sort of thoughts and feelings and emotions, it's then also the sort of the actions that are connected with those, and so obviously within a sporting scenario that can present a sort of decision making and then the actual execution skill as well that maybe come with the certain kind of emotions and thoughts that have potentially sort of underpinned those.
Yeah, because I think this is quite an interesting topic, because I think everyone sort of has a general idea of what they think psychology is, but I guess in a field like psychology, the preconceived ideas that people bring to what's happening when you're dealing with them as patients can actually impact the way that the treatment goes. So how important would you say that you know, the base level understanding of what people have of psychology actually impacts what it is that you do?
So I think it's a great question, because sometimes, very often if I'm working in a group scenario, I'll put the question to them and I'll sort of say, what do you think psychology or sports psychology is? And that's when you get words like mindset and mentality and things like that. There's definitely evidence to show that, in particular, I guess, in one-to-one stuff, the more that you believe that the thing is going to work, the more likely it is that it will. So having that kind of rapport with a client early on and sort of potentially even trying to, you know, you never want to feel like you're sort of having to necessarily kind of sell yourself too much, but actually if you can give someone something quite early on in the sort of the process of working with them that they can take away, try out and see some small gains from that, that's always helpful, because then if you do need to go into a slightly sort of more prolonged work with them where maybe it's a little bit harder to make those sort of marginal gains, at least they've already got that, they've got that emotional kind of buy-in to the process already. So yeah, it's an interesting one.
This isn't on the running order, but there are lots of different types of approaches to psychological treatment. Could you sort of give us an overview of roughly, obviously it doesn't need to be exhaustive, but how different is it going to be for, particularly in the world of sports anyway, that you're going to see a huge spread of different types of psychologists, or do the sports psychologists tend to follow one approach?
So a good question. It's a tricky one, because so depending on how highfalutin you want to go with it, within psychology there are definitely a pretty wide array of different sort of approaches, and actually you can get quite philosophical with that quite quickly. You know, you can get into the nature of sort of the nature of truth and learning and whether reality is subjective or objective and things like that. I think generally within sports psychology, because of the nature of the work where the people tend to be quite solution focused, time is very often pretty limited, and also potentially budgets as well, it probably leans towards certain sort of slightly, I guess perhaps you might term them sort of newer, but also maybe kind of more slightly scientific based sort of approaches. So CBT, so cognitive behavioral therapy, then some of the newer ones off the back of that as sort of ACT. And then there are all sorts of other ones which basically just become a bit of alphabet soup. So there's REBT, there's FAST ACT or FACT, there's CFT, compassion focused therapy. So there's lots of different ones, and what you'll end up often, I think most sports psychologists will maybe have one that kind of is their broad foundation, that's their maybe kind of go-to, and then they may sort of pluck from others as and when. But broadly, a lot of those ones are the ones that tend to sort of be a little bit more kind of, okay, we're evidence-based. We like the idea of sort of using scales and screenings and things so that we can kind of determine progress in a slightly more scientific way. And I think that then lends itself particularly to kind of performance domains, where that would be how generally the rest of a sports science team would be appraised, right? It, you know, you don't get the physio just kind of go, oh, it seems better. He says he feels better. Yeah, and then you just kind of move on with that. No, you want to know, well, okay, yeah, what's his return to play date? So, yeah.
So you talked about the newer approaches there. That would be contrasted with older approaches that would be what, more Freudian? So it's this idea you have of like lying on a sofa and talking about your development as a person.
I guess for one's word, a better phrase. And yes, I do think that, well, the newer older thing is perhaps a bit of a blunt definition there or distinction. But yeah, certainly that sort of the idea that things are a little bit, the term more often used is kind of humanistic, and that's where it's a sort of slightly more subjective view of the world, where you're aiming for sort of essentially a slightly less clear defined, I guess, solution to it, of just sort of feeling better about yourself, kind of feeling a sense of overall well-being. Which
so it seems a bit more narrative based then. It's sort of like talking to a person about their self-awareness and their feelings and their emotions and moving towards a solution that way, whereas the other one feels a little bit more scientific, where you're saying, well, we'll do this and then reassess and see if there's been an improvement.
Yeah, I think broadly that's a fair way to kind of summarize them. And that's not to say that there aren't humanistic sports psychologists out there and all the rest of it, but I think that's probably a decent rule of thumb.
So staying generic at the outset then, what would you say the job of the psychologist is, given that we've talked about what psychology is? What should a psychologist be trying to achieve?
So in terms of their ultimate goal, for the most part, certainly with one-to-one work, they're aiming for their own redundancy. So you are always trying to get your and I think that's probably broadly true of most therapies, is you're trying to sort of provide the tools to the person so that they can go away and use them, and you know, maybe they need an infrequent sort of check-in just to make sure things are okay. But within more broadly than that, there's, you know, it tends to be very contextual. So whether you're working particularly at an individual level, whether you're working more as a sort of team level, squad level, or potentially even working organizationally, where you're actually trying to structure the entire, you know, within a football setting, it might be sort of trying to make sure that the first 11 and all of the academy are all kind of pulling in the same direction, potentially even playing the same types of styles of football, or certainly that have the same sort of values in mind and all the rest of it. So, and how you can kind of create an environment that sort of allows people to really sort of thrive and excel. And you're sort of, yeah, that then becomes one where you're dealing with the coaches, the players, and all the support staff as well.
So it sounds very similar to other jobs in football clubs, but just from a psychological point of view.
Yeah.
Yeah. We had a lot of questions from listeners who wanted to talk about the difference between psychologists and sports psychologists. So someone whose Twitter name is lots of B's in a row said, I've been wondering for a while, what is the defining difference between a sports psychologist and a regular psychologist, other than just working with athletes?
So I think they've almost answered the question themselves, I guess, to some extent. It does tend to be a bit more solution focused. So you tend to have someone who comes with a specific topic or I'm always loath to use the word issue, but you know, something that they're aware of that they want to work on. That's not always the case. And I'm also, I guess, keen at the outset to sort of say that, you know, sports psychology doesn't have to just be reactive. It doesn't have to just be about sort of solving problems or treating issues or anything like that. It can also definitely be a sort of a proactive kind of additive skill set that's kind of being used to sort of take people from good to great and great to world class, or however you want to think about it. But when time is limited, you do often end up working with the people who are like, oh, I feel like I'm not getting the most out of myself in the big games. That tends to be the way that it sort of breaks down. In terms of what that actually means, though, you know, broadly, we're using the same types of skills and tools that most other sort of psychologists, certainly if you come from one of the sort of disciplines that we spoke about. So if you're a CBT-based sports psychologist, you'll be using the same theories and tools that any CBT psychologist would use, almost regardless of the topic or kind of area that you're working in. But you're just going to be using it in a way that is about, okay, well, I'm feeling a little bit unmotivated right now, or my confidence feels low in these certain particular kind of situations or settings or whatever it happens to be.
Well, I mean, this is going to be presumably how long is a piece of string type answer, but what would you say that you might expect a sports psychologist day to look like working within a club?
Yes. I was conscious walking in here today to try and avoid just saying it depends as the answer to every single question. You might need a klaxon for that or something. But yeah, it does. And you know, I think particularly within professional football, where there's still a kind of an element where the manager sets the tone hugely for the structures kind of potentially within an organization, and or certainly how those structures actually interact with the manager and the decision makers and the players, you know, within that squad. I think there's a huge amount of variation around that as well. So there will be some clubs out there where you will have, the sports psychologist will be readily available sort of every day that the players are there and at the training. They can stop in, or the psychologist will kind of come and seek them out. I think often the sort of the meal times tend to be sort of relatively kind of easy access when people are feeling a little bit kind of sort of more off the clock, and the sports psychologist can kind of potentially sort of just wander around and be available. But then there will probably be others where potentially they're a little bit more removed, I guess, from the sort of day-to-day ongoings, but it's more a case of they would report into potentially the head of sports science. The head of sports science might be then reporting into a director of football, who's then sort of reporting back to the manager or whatever. And so there might be a slightly more kind of convoluted route there. Unfortunately, it does kind of depend a lot on how that setup works. But there will definitely be face-to-face work with the players themselves. That will just often be a case of, like, is that sort of strongly encouraged? Is it a kind of case-by-case basis? Is it, is the sports psychologist having to kind of sit down next to them in the team canteen and kind of tap them on the shoulder and be like, hey, I don't think we've ever spoken before? Or are they kind of able to kind of come and find them in a relatively discreet way? A lot of that then depends, on the setup, the internal structures, and also potentially even the sort of the facilities as well, as to whether there's, where the players tend to kind of literally physically spend their time.
Will there be group sessions at all?
Yes, I think that's probably one of the things that's the most sort of common, would be at least sort of trying to have some sort of input on some of that would, although again that probably depends on the manager and how, I guess, perhaps how tight a ship they want to have. Having said that, there are also definitely, I know of sports psychologists who've worked within teams and organizations where, they report directly into the manager, and they're very much, if the manager is sort of keen on the concept of sports psychology, and they have a very close working relationship, and therefore that access to sort of actually the sports psychologist will be really kind of on hand, will be giving those kind of group sessions on a regular basis, will kind of potentially be in the changing rooms before matches at halftime, that kind of thing as well. So, but it does, as with so much, it does unfortunately depend.
We had a question from David Beffert, who said, have you seen Ted Lasso, and what did you think of the depiction of the sports psychologist on that show? I've not watched the show, so I'm in your hands here.
So I'll confess, I've only seen the first two seasons, and the second season is where the sports psychologist rocks up. I think the answer to this question I will give as two sentences, and I will let people perhaps draw their own conclusions. The first is, Ted Lasso as a character was kind of developed to be very, very different to the sort of classic Premier League manager. Sentence number one. Sentence number two is, inadvertently or perhaps intuitively, he's quite good at sports psychology. Like I said, those two are out there as sentences. When they then decided to kind of give him a bit of a sort of antagonist to sort of bounce off, they brought in the sports psychologist. Mm-hmm. Which was a little bit strange watching it, because you're like, well, he's actually already pretty decent at that. And that's not to say that you can't still have a sports psychologist there. It's always nice to have a slightly different voice, putting it in slightly different ways, reinforcing the same messages. But what they then did, because it's a TV show, right, is they actually set up that character to be sort of the antithesis of Ted. Mm-hmm. And so the sports psychologist comes across as very aloof, quite cold, quite reserved. There's a scene, I think, perhaps even in the first episode where she's introduced, where she comes and sort of observes the training session and does so sort of in full, kind of just in civvies. She's in a sort of big kind of overcoat, looking, for want of a better word, maybe it's a very sort of gender-loaded word, but she's looking a bit frumpy, very serious. And she sort of sat in the very highest tier of seating within the stands, you know, looking on very coldly. And I think that's probably pretty much a kind of textbook what not to do as a sports psychologist. And every sports psychologist I know of who's, you know, well, whatever situation they work in, would be there in the team kit on the touchlines, even if they're not necessarily actively involved in sort of the drills and things, would be very obviously present and kind of close to the action and making themselves look available, look willing to talk, you know, and all the rest of it. So,
what impact do you think that public representations of sports psychologists can have on your job? Have you ever come across scenarios where you feel as though you're having to unteach things that people have picked up?
I think it's nice to see it represented at all. And I guess the one thing I do also like is that at least that sports psychologist is I think I'm pretty sure she's a doctor, so she's got a doctorate somewhere, so she's, you know, she's well trained, one hopes, in sports psychology. I think the bigger question probably is just about the sort of the long-standing stigma around mental health and opening up to that, and I think there's quite a lot of variation from one sport to another. There's also a very big generational shift that's happening there, but I think, to perhaps massively oversimplify, but you know, football is probably one of the sports where that stigma is still perhaps stronger than it might be in others. So that's probably more a case of trying to kind of knock down those barriers, and therefore actually having a sports psychologist in Ted Lasso who then, you know, well, she ends up with her own office again, perhaps living in the world of TV fiction, she ends up with her own office. But you know, actually the players come and talk to her and open up and see benefits from that. So actually, in that sense, that's probably quite a helpful bit of representation.
Anecdotally, over the course of your time as a sports psychologist, have you seen attitudes to mental health and psychology being maybe relaxed a little bit?
I think probably yes. And I guess actually, it's maybe not so much over my time, but perhaps with the clients that I work with. When I work with older clients, they might be less willing to open up about certain things, or maybe there's just a little bit of having to kind of win them over a bit more. One of the things that, you know, I'll often sort of just get asked by mates, like, oh man, it must be really hard when you're stuck kind of opposite a sort of a 15-year-old boy who's, you know, and you're asking them about their feelings. And actually sometimes they're the easiest, like they genuinely are. You know, I think there has been a really big shift, and I think it's just being part of that is that mental health is just a much bigger topic anyway. And I think there is also just a bit more of an understanding that if you really want to make it in these hyper competitive sports, including football, obviously, is, you know, you kind of want to take the resources where you can. And if sports psychology is one of the areas where you can make those little marginal gains, then, you know, you'd kind of be foolish to sort of turn your nose up at it. So yeah, I think with those younger clients who potentially are of that sort of newer generation, you can see those differences.
I'm going to jump forward on the running order a little bit, because I think we're talking about the role of sports psychologists. And I think everyone falls into this trap of thinking the sports psychologist is going to sit down with players who are struggling and help them out. So I think maybe we should start with that, because I think that's where the listeners may expect us to go. But we had a listener question that you initially didn't really want to talk about. And that was from actually friend of the podcast, Ruben Pinder, who has been on this podcast a number of occasions. He simply asked, tongue-in-cheek, no doubt, why did Kane miss that penalty against France? This is the big sort of topic that I think a lot of people think sports psychologists, right? What's the famous sports psychologist, Steve Peters, yeah, this kind of thing, right? It's like you want to get your players into this scenario where you're able to almost sit above emotions and not worry about what's going on around you. You want to be completely in tune with the football, you score the penalty. This is what I think most people think of when they think of sports psychology. And this is a topic that you've actually specialized on during your career, and your PhD is on this topic. And this is the topic of choking. So let's start off with an easy question. What is choking?
If that were an easy question, I wouldn't need to be doing any research on it. Definitions in psychology in general are really tricky, right? Because you're trying to sort of neatly summarize the human experience, and you're kind of trying to do so in, you know, a dozen words or so, and that's always tricky to do. So to my mind, choking would be something along the lines of a sort of, you know, a really sort of borderline catastrophic underperformance and in quite a kind of an acute way, right? So it's a sort of a very temporary, contextual underperformance that is, yeah, really sort of out of character. And certainly would be kind of out of any sort of, if you expect that you've kind of got a medium, an average performance, and you kind of got a kind of bit of volatility around that, you'd be talking well outside of the sort of expected range, not to, if that's not too mathematical. So I would partly question whether even a penalty can be considered choking under pressure, because, there's an XG of whatever it is, 0.79, right? So that does mean that you're going to miss some, right? So is it definitely a catastrophic underperformance to not score that penalty? Who's to say, right? Mm. And perhaps the only person on earth who could say is Harry Kane himself. So, you know, choking as a kind of a phenomenon, I think, is pretty well regarded as existing, right? It's something that a lot of sports people have experienced, where they, you know, in a certain moment they kind of can barely perform even the most basic of skills and really go to pieces. It's just a case of then trying to sort of summarize that neatly in a definition, but also then how do you use that, and how can you, from a research perspective, how can you then recreate those situations to try and test what causes choking, mm-hmm. what helps prevent choking, what helps, you know, if you're in that sort of mode, how can you break out of it? So that's a lot of where the sort of the research that I've kind of read up and done is around sort of trying to understand essentially sort of what different definitions are out there, mm-hmm. and how those have been, the technical word is kind of operationalized, how those have been used in those research situations to try and understand the phenomenon better.
I think maybe the mainstream account of what happens in those scenarios is that you, when you're a sports player at the highest level, so much of what you do is just almost unaware. And what happens when you're choking is you try and raise something that you just do naturally to the level of self-awareness. Is that a good definition, or is that one of the ones that you're sort of working against? Yeah,
it's spot on. There is a specific word for almost exactly what you've just described there, which is reinvestment. And I think coming back to the original question that I was initially reluctant to answer, right? But why did Kane miss that penalty? Is in those stressful moments, you're exactly right. You know, these are people who have spent thousands and thousands and thousands of hours honing these skills. They are completely second nature to them, completely automatic. In certain moments of extreme pressure, do they try and essentially bring more conscious attention to what they're doing than is actually helpful? And that actually causes them to essentially almost revert from being an expert who can do these things automatically. You almost fall into a sort of novice territory where you've actually broken it down into the constituent parts. Mm-hmm. So if you sort of were to think about, like, okay, well, rather than Harry Kane just kind of putting the ball down on the spot, or a footballer putting the ball down on the spot, or a golfer preparing for their swing, instead of just doing it and letting the sort of muscle memory take over, they actually start to think, okay, well, what am I going to try and do here? How am I going to do this differently? What do I need to be doing? Where am I planting my foot? How am I going to move my sort of hips? How am I going to do this? How am I going to do that? And you've actually taken something that actually they could do practically in their sleep, and they've now made it much more mechanical, therefore much more clunky. They've taken one process, score a penalty or hit the golf ball, and they've broken it down into dozens or even hundreds of sort of separate stages. And each of those stages is susceptible to failure. And so then you end up, not executing anywhere near the standard that you would expect them to.
Yeah, and look, as someone who goes on podcasts a lot, I could tell you that something as simple as speaking to another person, which you just do all the time, right? As soon as you have a microphone in front of you and you're expected to say profound things, it can become very, very difficult. I presume that's in the same sort of realm.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's, I think, a lot of everyday examples, you know, whether it's sort of, if someone asked you, how do you tie your own shoelaces? I think most people would really struggle to do it. And actually, if they were then asked to sort of, a lot of the experiments on reinvestment ask people to essentially sort of talk through their actions as they're doing them. So if someone sort of stood over you and was like, oh, teach me how to tie your own shoelaces, you'd potentially struggle, because actually your fingers just do it naturally, automatically. And similarly, you know, learning how to drive a car, you know, learning how to tie a tie, these are the kinds of things where actually when you break them down and give them that conscious attention, it becomes really, really tricky to remember, well, what is the specific order I do and how do I do them accurately enough to actually make this work? Because, yeah, you're just doing it through that sort of muscle memory at this point.
Interestingly, I was doing a PhD in philosophy and focusing on the concept of subjectivity, what it means to experience the world perceptually. One of the big philosophers in that area is a guy called Charles Taylor. And one of the things that he often used to say is you couldn't learn how to ride a bike by reading a book. It's the same kind of idea there, right? Which is often when you're trying to learn these embodied actions that we're talking about here, you have to learn by doing it. You can't learn it by having the theoretical aspect in your head. And I think, you know, this all ties into the same kind of idea that actually what athletes are doing is trying to embody learning rather than necessarily have head learning as well. But following up from that, we had a question from False Pivot on Twitter, who said, what is necessary to create an environment in which players play without fear? How can you help players that choke under pressure? So what is the solution to these sorts of problems that players can come up against?
I think from a practical perspective, a lot of it will come back to essentially trying to sort of keep game day relatively simple. Yeah, and if you think about it in terms of one of the elements around the sort of the automatic execution that we just spoke about there of kind of when you reach that expert level, is not only is it much more consistent, it also requires less brain power, essentially, right? And we do have a limited amount of kind of cognitive processing power. And in a game like football, which is so complicated, right, you need to be aware of where you are, where the ball is, where all of your teammates are, all of your opponents, the conditions, blah, 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 right? The processing that's required to accurately make decisions in that sort of infinite number of different kind of contexts is mind-blowing. If you're also overthinking, how do I play this 2-yard pass? There's no hope for you, right? And so one of the benefits of being able to execute the skills automatically is it frees up the brain to do the other processing of the situational stuff around you. And so trying to limit, I think, the technical feedback that's happening potentially immediately before and during matches, and just sort of saying, like, listen, you know how to do that, right? You've been kicking a ball since you were probably a toddler, right? In most cases for professional footballers, right? Don't overthink that element. You just need to be, you know, trying to kind of keep the instruction simple, right? But what we do want you to do is just be a little bit more, you know, front-footed, or trying to spot that player a little bit more often, or trying to make that run broadly into that part of the pitch a bit more often or a bit less often. And if you're trying to just sort of keep it reasonably simple in those terms, rather than a kind of massive breakdown of you're going to pass it here, 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 and here, and you need to be keeping your hips like this and you're planting your foot like that and so on.
Is that why Pep Guardiola gives those instructions at the end of games then? Is he being a good sports psychologist then?
Potentially, yeah. And I think, you know, it's interesting because I think a lot of sports psychology ends up being relatively intuitive in some senses. It's a phrase I end up using a lot in the work that I do, is, you know, this isn't necessarily rocket science. It's not going to be revolutionary necessarily, but it is going to help, right? And so actually it's just a case of, yeah, some of these, you know, a lot of these elite managers, right, they don't get to the position they're at without having a reasonable understanding of what's going to get people performing at their best. Not to say there perhaps isn't some room for improvement, but, you know, there is kind of, you know, an understanding, oh, okay, well, actually, if I'm giving this information to them at halftime, they all start getting really clunky and awkward and they can't execute anything. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I'll save it until the full-time whistle's gone, and then I'll kind of load them with that information.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX, stream on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer, if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/credit card.
We've talked a lot about choking here. How much do you think that actually happens at the highest level of elite football? Because it's something that I think golf is one that's often used, right? Where they talk about yips, where a golfer is standing over a putt and then suddenly they lose the ability to be able to play the shots that they're expected to play. And I suppose similar to penalties, okay, it's hard to say a player is choked for a penalty because they only will take one or two in a game. With putting, like, you're doing a fair amount of it when you're going on a round, and it massively impacts your performance. Do you think that we don't actually see that much choking at the highest level of football?
There's certainly a case for that, I think, yeah. And I think you're completely right. So a lot of if you kind of look for the sort of the popular examples out there on the internet of choking examples, they do come overwhelmingly from sports like golf and tennis, which are individual sports. So there's no team context to sort of hide behind or confuse things. And yeah, there's a repetitive nature, right? Where you've built a massive lead and then, so they've been performing in one way and then you go to pieces and they can't get the ball over the net or can't putt a ball. Within football, I think it's potentially a little harder to identify just because it is hard to know whether it's one person having an absolute stinker or not, and whether it's the whole team kind of being a little bit dysfunctional. I do think it almost certainly happens, but it would be, for me, certainly with the definitions that I like to use for choking, I think it would have to be perhaps starting a match in one particular way and then something happening within that completely throws you off. And so you'd have a player who is fine for maybe the first 20 minutes, first half, maybe first 60 minutes. Then there's a kind of a clear, massive deterioration in their sort of quality, perhaps because they actually missed a shot, missed an opportunity that wasn't choking, but has maybe now kind of set the wheels in motion in their head, and now they are overthinking everything and sort of now getting it more clunky. That breakdown has happened.
Sure. Something that happens a lot more often is that a player can underachieve, and then fans, as Aaron Hanlon says, can often interpret this as a lack of motivation. They don't care, they're happy to collect a paycheck, stealing a living, etc. Aaron says, this seems wrong to me, but what is usually going on mental health-wise for chronic underperformers in that sense? So this is less choking, I think, and more just being out of your rhythm as an athlete.
Yeah, and I think that is a helpful definition, right, is the difference between choking, which I think most people would agree is within a match or something, this is kind of a longer-term slump. I think I agree with the sort of premise of the question. I certainly think I would draw a distinction between unmotivated and demotivated. Mm-hmm. I think anyone who gets through academy football and makes it as a professional footballer out the other end, kind of not just Premier League, but that is an unbelievably grueling journey. You have to be highly, highly motivated, unbelievably motivated to get through that. If something then goes wrong, that perhaps is not necessarily because there's a kind of an innate defect in that person, right? It's perhaps contextual. I think there is also, though, we as human beings, as a society or whatever, do tend to think of motivation as quite a sort of a static trait. Oh, that is a motivated person or that is not a motivated person. Whereas I think it's a lot more dynamic than that, and also potentially contextual. You know, so people might be highly motivated in some areas of their life and not in others, and motivated by different incentives in some areas of their life than in others. If you're talking about a footballer, you know, coming through the systems that they have, I think getting to a point where they have felt that motivation drop off, I would classify more as demotivated rather than unmotivated. And then the question becomes, okay, so what has happened there? And it may be that it is kind of a little bit more internal, in that, you know, they may have really thrived on being a big fish in a small pond, you know, having been the best under six, the best under seven, you know, all the way up. And now all of a sudden they're in the senior squad and they're surrounded by other individuals who are better than them, more experienced than them, physically more, you know, a stronger, fitter, faster, all the rest of it. That may be what's happened. Or it could be that, you know, there are just sort of elements within the coach-athlete relationship that aren't quite working. There may be broader elements within the sort of the culture more generally within the club or within that squad as well. So again, lots of different factors.
It depends.
Indeed.
No, I can attest to that, because I feel as though I'm quite a motivated person when I'm sitting down to watch my fifth game of football for the day. But when it comes to doing my laundry, I feel very unmotivated. So I suppose it is a complex concept. Another thing that we had a question about, and I think this is interesting, because I think we'll maybe go off on a little bit of a tangent after this, but we had a question from Chris who said, how do you tame hot-headedness or head loss in a player, opposite to building confidence? How do you focus on those hot-headed players? And we can come to the answer of that question, how you answer it, but I thought it was maybe to start off, just I would say not everyone is coded in the same way when it comes to something like motivation. So speaking personally, I feel as though I was someone who performed better when I was a little bit pissed off during games. How much scope is there when you're dealing with players to sort of get a sense of what style of personality they are, how their psychology functions, and how that can impact motivation? Is that, presumably there, again, you're going to say it depends, but presumably there is a spectrum of different types of player types in that sense?
For sure. And I think that's one of the really tricky elements about sort of sports psychology is, I think very often when you're working within a sort of a kind of organizational or squad level, and potentially if you're doing that sort of the kind of the group work that we kind of mentioned earlier, you're going to try and go with the sort of the options that are kind of most likely to benefit the most people in the squad and do the least harm to the others, right? So you're kind of balancing all of those factors, which means that you potentially aren't going to, you're definitely not going to provide something super useful to every single person in that squad, right? And there will be some people who on that particular, you know, and then you get into the specifics of, okay, well, today we're going to talk about confidence. Okay, there may be some people in the room whose confidence is absolutely wonderful, or some person's motivation might be absolutely spot on, right? And so they're just not, they don't kind of even necessarily need to be in the room if that's a sort of more, how do we redress an issue here? That being said, you know, there are those distinctions, and if you can work one-on-one with those individual athletes and sort of get a sense of, okay, well, what is it that's going to kind of, that does spur you on, what does help you get into your best, you know, the mindset that's going to work best for you, that is going to be a very kind of a personal kind of exploration. And a lot of the work when I sort of work with athletes about sort of trying to develop essentially sort of pre-match routines and things like that is, how do you, you know, is essentially the first step of that is reflecting back on their own performances and going, well, when have you kind of surprised yourself by outperforming your average? What was it that kind of triggered that? And for some people, you're spot on, right? It's the something's happened early in the match that's kind of really rankled them. It's got their blood up, and they're kind of, they go, you know, the red mist descends and they play a blinder. For others, they've gone for a, you know, early shower 2 minutes after that because they've gone in two-footed. So there's elements within that are going to be sort of tailored to each person. So what if you're working within a group scenario, you're sort of asking people to reflect on those and then figure out, okay, so what is the kind of combination of psychological characteristics that's going to be most helpful for you to get ready for a match? What can you be doing before the match? What are you doing at halftime to get yourself into that zone where you perform best? And understanding that zone is going to be very personal to you. So you don't need to be doing the same thing as the guy sat next to you in the changing room, because they might have a very different mindset that they're aiming for.
You mentioned confidence there. I was interested to hear your thoughts actually on there's certain situations where maybe a lack of confidence could be considered a positive trait, where it could spur you on to, I don't know, practice more or improve as a person. Do you think that having high confidence is always beneficial in a high performance environment like sport? Is there any context in sport where you think maybe a lack of confidence could translate into good production output?
That's a very good question. I'm not sure I've ever ever really thought about it in that way. My instinct is probably to say probably not, in as much as actually similar to the question just before about, you know, but with the idea of sort of if a bad thing happens and it sparks a good performance, or here are sort of having a lack of confidence and that sort of creating that will to continue to improve. Generally, the avoiding a bad thing can be really, really motivating, or can be very effective, but it tends to be quite short-termist.
Sure.
So that might work for a little while, but it probably won't. And it may also definitely have, you know, sort of knock-on effects, right? So you may suddenly train like a demon because you're absolutely convinced you've got imposter syndrome and you don't deserve to be there. It's then going to be really hard when you sort of cross the line on match day to go, yeah, no, it's all right, I've got this, I know what I'm doing, right? And so sure. I think probably trying to bring that sort of the motivation more around a sort of a rewards focus, like seeking the benefits of whether that's setting longer term goals of like, you know, you want to win this or play for that team or earn this much a week or whatever the right incentive might be for you. Or if it's just, you know, I think ideally then actually beyond that is, okay, and what are you getting out of it on a sort of session by session basis? What are the things that you're actually enjoying in terms of sort of learning your craft, developing yourself and all those sort of aspects as well?
And to come back to the question from Chris, how do you tame hot-headedness? Or head loss in players? I guess that's about dampening down emotions rather than lifting them up.
Yes, probably. I think, although I would be keen to ask the player first, you know, not to totally cop out on it, because, you know, I think there is also an argument where potentially there is almost a sort of sense of like, if you're feeling, I guess, panicked or kind of insecure about either your own performance or the position that the team is in that moment, you know, are you making those sort of rash challenges out of a sort of, is it a kind of because you are like overly kind of topped up on anger, you know, or sort of like the kind of the hot-headedness, or is it that actually you're under on confidence in yourself, confidence in your teammates? So are you kind of having to lunge in there because you don't trust your centre back partner to actually, you know, get in behind you afterwards if you don't get the guy, you know, so you'd rather just bring the guy down and see what happens because actually you don't trust those people around you, or potentially that you don't trust yourself to be able to follow on, you know, if you do then get beaten. So I think I'd want to kind of understand a bit more about like, well, what to the extent that you're aware of what's going on, what are you kind of thinking, what is driving that hot-headedness or apparent hot-headedness, and then you kind of go from there.
We've talked a lot about the psychological aspect when it goes wrong with players, and as we've said, that tends to be the area that people immediately go to in their heads when they think of sports psychology. But presumably a big part of your job is also keeping players in a good place, and you know, the same way that physiotherapist departments in clubs will be obviously treating players who are injured, but they're also trying to keep the players at the highest level possible as well. So what does that look like from the point of view of a sports psychologist? How much of your job is actually based around keeping people in the good place rather than trying to pull them out of the bad place?
The short answer is not enough. Or yeah, I think a lot of sports psychologists would love to have the time and the resource to do more of that kind of proactive stuff and the sort of really additive things of sure. keeping people where they want to be and slowly enhancing that. Within some settings that definitely does happen. I think when you have a sort of a club or an organization who's potentially not had any sports psych before, you almost always, the first job is the firefighting, it's the problem solving. As you become more embedded, then you can start to kind of maybe sort of tweak the more sort of structural things. I think a lot of it becomes around sort of trying to create environments in which people feel comfortable to sort of take slight risks and fail. You know, there's a kind of the slogans that come out of sort of startups sometimes, of sort of being willing to fail fast and learn from it and kind of move on from it. There's sort of elements around that, and that very often gets sort of labeled as kind of psychological safety. So actually knowing that if you've gone out there, you've tried a thing, potentially because the manager has specifically tried, told you to try it, it's not quite gone to plan because you're not used to doing it that way, but you're not going to come in and get the hairdryer treatment from the same manager who told you to go out there and try it in the first place. But also that you're not going to get that from the players around you. They're not going to drop their heads. And so it becomes, but you can imagine that takes quite a lot of time to build that kind of camaraderie and trust. And also that sort of sense of like, oh, okay, yeah, I'm okay with the fact that we actually had quite a promising move there and it's broken down and I was waiting for the cross that they've messed up, but I'm not going to get frustrated about it because I appreciate that what they were trying to do was a bit different and a bit new.
I think a lot of what we're talking about here is, players at the top of their game, at the peak of their careers. We had a lot of questions about the psychologist's role at the academy level. Mm-hmm. I think this is really interesting from the point of view that actually we're not just talking about keeping young players in a good mind space, but also talking about actually developing them as psychological subjects in the first place. So we had a question from the fantastically named Arsenal FC Taylor's Version. What role does psychology and mental health care play at the youth academy level? How do you help young players, especially those with a lot of early hype, to deal with pressure and scrutiny? And I think, there's two levels there. There's the fact that you want to help them at the moment that they're at, but also this longer-term vision where you want to think, okay, this player is interesting from the point of view that they're still developing their personality and still developing their psychological profile, and decisions we make at this point in their career could impact them in the long run.
So for sure, yes. There's, I think, a lot in there that is really important to sort of understand and kind of really get on board with. That the footballing pyramid, through the academy structure is really brutal, and there are moves in the right direction. So all category one academies have to have some psychology provision. So that's, in order to achieve that accreditation, which is the highest level within England, you have to have a sports psych on your staff. What's then required of that sports psychologist is pretty vague. So I think there's probably a little bit of room for improvement about what they then go on to do. But there is definitely an embedding of sports psychology, or at least the sort of first steps of embedding sports psychology in an academy environment. And there is a sort of move to just sort of see it as one of the kind of the default sports science resources that any academy should have. And hopefully that gets rolled out across the other categories as well. There is, though, there are so many kids playing within these setups, and very often you'll have one sports psychologist who's responsible for every element of it, from the, one-to-one work, the group work, the organizational structural stuff. They're doing the reactive stuff. They're doing the proactive stuff. Yeah. So it gets very kind of time consuming. And that also it's very often not the best paid job in sports psychology. So very often you'll get people who are still quite early in their career taking that role on, which isn't obviously to say that they're bad at that, but they probably don't have a ton of experience in doing quite such a vast variety of roles. So there's definitely room for improvement for what that provision looks like, but I think it's still really good that it is happening, and hopefully that is also helping to sort of break down that stigma that exists where, because you've had people who've kind of like, they've seen the staff sports psych kind of wandering around in their tracksuit since they were in the kind of, you know, under whatevers, that they just sort of see that as part and parcel of being a footballer, being in an academy, being in a professional setup as a senior. So there's definitely steps in the right direction there. That being said, I think one of the, you know, one of the sort of the critical areas, and I think this is probably sort of, I would hope this isn't too controversial, is, you know, obviously the kind of the process through which, as you know, those kids kind of who don't make it are released, you know, that's obviously a massive life-changing moment for those individuals. And, you know, and football is not the only sport where this happens, right? It's like, oh, okay, well, you're off the program. So now we're also obviously going to remove all of the resources that were around you as well, including the sports psychology. So actually that transition, you'd love to have a sports psychologist who could try and help them kind of build a bit more of like, okay, well, what is your identity outside of football? How do you kind of go from here? What are some tools that might serve you well? Obviously, you know, with, I think there are some academies who potentially provide a small amount of that, you know, they're not required to, but they do. But yeah, you'd kind of love to see a little bit more of that, just to kind of potentially sort of ease that transition.
So it's starting to see sports psychologists across all of the areas of football clubs. So we had some questions actually about the role of sports psychologists in the recruitment process as well. So Lee M. Direct says, do sports psychologists play any role in recruitment regarding players? When a player is scouted, is there likely to be, say, a psychological profile done on a player to say this guy would do well at this club with these players and this manager?
It's a really interesting question. As far as I'm aware, I don't know of anyone where that is definitely the case. Or certainly not where, I guess, not where the kind of day-to-day sports psychologist is being kind of actively invited to sort of pass comment or whatever.
Presumably that's just because it's hard to do that kind of psychological profiling without just sitting down and talking to the player.
Quite. And if you wanted to do it in any kind of scientific kind of way, where you were like, okay, well, we've administered this survey or whatever, you know, to all of our current squad and our manager and our assistant managers, and this is, you know, you'd then need your potential transfer target to sit down and fill in the same scale to then cross-reference, which I'm guessing would be kind of a bit weird, right, if you were doing that before an agreement was even sort of in place. So I think pragmatically it would be tricky to do. I suspect also for a lot of sports psychs that would feel maybe ethically a little bit kind of like a bit of a gray area as well. To be kind of, yeah, making those sorts of decisions based on that. You know, I think even those psychologists who are more scientific minded kind of see the world more objectively, most people are willing to admit that those scales and tests and screenings and things, you have to take them with a bit of a pinch of salt. So if you were making those decisions based off that, I think that would potentially be kind of quite a risky way of going about things. So yeah,
we're starting to talk a lot about player welfare now. I think we've talked about kids being dropped off programs and having to deal with that. There's another, I think, interesting tension in professional sport, particularly in terms of when it comes to player welfare, and that is, you know, the complex relationship between winning and welfare, I suppose. So we've had a couple of questions about this. So Darcy says, how does a psychologist balance helping maximize performance with the well-being of players that they work with? I imagine this can often be a flashpoint. And Aaron Daniel says, have you ever come to the conclusion that football or the pressure of playing professional football is the root cause of a player's unhappiness? If so, how do you balance the player's well-being versus the ambitions of the player and the club? What if quitting is the key to happiness and fulfillment? And that tension exists, I think, again, across a lot of areas in a football club, particularly when it comes to physiology as well. Physiotherapists often have to make decisions where they're telling a coach, you shouldn't play this player really, but the coach is going to say, well, my job depends on it, and the performance of the team can depend on it. Leads you into this very tricky kind of areas. So I'm interested in your thoughts on that, how you get the balance right, particularly when it's, you would say that the prime aspect of a psychologist is probably focusing on player welfare, having the player in a good place. in that kind of environment where there is that tension between sometimes winning is prioritized over actually does it matter if we're going to have negative consequences on players?
So I think it's an excellent question. There definitely can be a tension there. I suspect it actually may be less common than it might initially seem. Mm-hmm. If for no other reason than, you know, at its simplest, you know, generally a happy sportsman is a successful, or happy sports person is a successful sports person, and vice versa. So generally, if you've got someone who's feeling pretty good about themselves, they will go out and play their sport in a really good way. And
which isn't there with the physiological side of things, right? Because you can be doing things that actively are damaging you and playing at the height of your career.
Exactly. So I think there probably is a little bit of a difference there potentially between the psychology and the other sort of sports sciences. You know, and actually I think the other part of that is, you know, if what you're thinking about is, okay, well, this person, you know, very often, bit of an oversimplification for sure, but if you're thinking about what it takes to be sort of, you know, how you're kind of almost kind of diagnosing someone who's not quite there where they want to be psychologically, it's okay, well, they're training at this level and they're not translating it into matches. Well, pulling them from the matches isn't necessarily going to help them, right? You what you're going to try and do as the sports psychologist there is give them skills, tools to try out, but those will take practice, right? Psychological skills are skills like any other. The more you practice them, generally the more effective they're going to be, or certainly there's going to be a learning process, right? So you're going to need to use those contextually. You know, there are slight ways around it, but for the most part, you know, there is no way really to replicate the pressure of a second penalty against your home keeper in a quarterfinal of a World Cup other than doing it, right? And so you kind of figure out how you do that, you know, as you go along. And so therefore, actually, sometimes you do just have to play through it. That's not to say that it's never an issue, and that can definitely be quite a tricky tension to sort of overcome. I think a lot of times the sort of the option there, psychologists and sports psychologists, we kind of talk a lot about our philosophies and our sort of values and things to sort of guide us in some of these tricky moments, and understanding, having a pretty clear idea in your own head, essentially sort of who the client is, right? So is the client the footballer, or is it the person who pays the bill, which is the club? So who are you really working for? You know, are you working for the well-being of the player, where you're going to say, listen, I think the best thing for you right now is to actually, yeah, you know, pull out of the situation, because actually I think this is currently doing more harm than good, but that might not be what the manager and the rest of the club would like to hear. So that is, you know, but actually making that happen is really difficult. And again, we kind of come back to the question right early on about, well, what is the role of one particular sports psychologist within one particular football club? How much sway does that one psychologist have to make that decision? Or are they just going to, they pass it up the sports science chain and it kind of gets lost in amongst everything else, and it turns out the player just sort of keeps underperforming until eventually they're sort of pretty broken. So it's a tricky one to navigate for sure when it does come around, but I think probably slightly less common than maybe it might appear.
Yeah, and it's certainly the case that things seem to be improving. I can think of a number of players in the last 5 years who have been, I guess, PR'd as having had mental health problems and therefore taking a break, which would never have happened, I think, before 5 years ago. So there's clearly that buffer space within clubs to be able to accept that the mental health aspect is important to the performance of their players as well. One final question in the same sort of vein, but another aspect of modern life that can often affect player well-being is social media. Mm-hmm. So United Resurgent said, how would a sports psychologist approach a situation where the fan base has turned horribly toxic and out of proportion to the fact that it's a sport? Thinking of the abuse that Harry Maguire got as my example. Obviously, a lot of that can happen within the stadium, but the bigger arena where that's happening isn't social media, and it's never been easier, I suspect, for players to find out what the fans think of them than in the present day. So how do you deal with a player who is being dragged on social media?
It's an impossible question. I think a decent number of the players kind of are kind of, you know, certainly their official accounts will be managed by their PR team, so that probably isn't them themselves. generally, I think it's probably relatively safe to say that social media is probably not great news for anyone's mental health. If you thought you could, you would probably try and get all your players to sort of never touch a social media platform again. Whether that's realistic or not, I don't know. But I think it is extremely hard. And I actually think the way that the social media stuff fuels the stadium atmosphere, the people who are kind of putting together the sort of the fail compilations of whichever player it is that the club's fan base has turned against that week, and then that means that the first mistake they make next time out, however many thousand people in the stadium all groan collectively, right? It that's really unhelpful. And actually, even if you've therefore, as a player, you've avoided the social media drag, but you're just trying to go about your business and now you've made one simple mistake. No footballer is ever going to play a perfect 90-minute game, right? Everyone is going to have mistakes. And if the very first time you do that, the whole stadium's on your back, it's probably not going to set you up well to kind of bounce back from that. Or certainly it's going to make it a lot harder in most cases. You might get the occasional time where, I'll show them and it actually helps them raise their game. But that's probably going to be a relatively short-term fix for the situation. So I think it is, it's really tricky. I think it's probably just part and parcel of the game at this point where you as the psychologist, you're just trying to give the people the tools to build their confidence or build, retain their motivation, retain that sort of faith in the muscle memory and their ability to execute and remind them of the things that they do well as much as you possibly can. And, if you're getting that from your manager, you're getting that from the sports site, you're getting that from your teammates, you're creating that sort of kind of collective atmosphere where people understand that and, everyone's sort of reinforcing the same behaviors and kind of helping everyone build, confidence in a way of sort of almost just sort of identifying the evidence. Oh yeah, no, I'm actually pretty decent at this. That's obviously going to help kind of to sort of just try and offset, because, Joe Bloggs has kind of written something nasty about you or put together, a compilation of you kicking the ball out over and over and over again. So,
well, Alex, thank you so much for coming in and chatting to me. I could have carried on for a little bit longer. I've still got other questions that we weren't able to get around to. I've really enjoyed hearing your expertise on this. For our listeners, if they want to find out more about what it is that you're doing, you work for a company called Optimize Potential, and their website is optimizepotentialsport.com, and you are contactable through there, I believe. But thank you so much for coming on, and really enjoyed chatting to you.
Thank you for having me. Yeah, it's been a real treat. Cheers.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.